Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit is now open according to law. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome to the third day of our panel sitting here in Birmingham. I'm happy to be here with Judges Newsom and Brasher. Before we start, Judge Brasher has something he'd like to tell the attorneys.
All right. So this is our second sitting in Birmingham this year, and it's kind of a new thing we're trying out. You will get a survey after this argument about, you know, your experience with the facilities and finding the courthouse and stuff like that. It's anonymous. You don't get to grade the judges on the survey, unfortunately. But we just really appreciate it if you would. It's not, you know, a spam. It's actually a survey. So we'd appreciate it if you would fill it out and send it back. That's it.
All right, with that, we're ready to start. You understand the red light system. When the yellow light goes on, that means that your time is starting to draw to a close, so you can begin wrapping up. If we take you beyond the red light, then just keep going. And with that, our first case is number 23-11132, Michael Chapman versus Jefferson Dunn et al. Ms. Swartz.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Alexis Swartz for the appellant, Michael Chapman. In January of 2018, Mr. Chapman was found unconscious on the floor of his prison. He then discovered for the first time that he had a bone infection, a ruptured eardrum, and a brain abscess, all due to an ear infection that Nurse Charlie Waugh previously refused to treat. Additionally, doctors have recommended that Mr. Chapman receive cataract surgery in his right eye. He's functionally blind in this eye, yet the Alabama Department of Corrections has a blanket policy that prohibits him from receiving this much-needed surgery in violation of his constitutional rights. There are several reversible errors that the district court committed here, but there are two in particular that require this court to reverse and remand. First, there's this new immunity doctrine that prohibited Mr. Chapman's claim for prospective injunctive relief as to defendant Ham to remedy an ongoing constitutional violation. Second, the district court did not have the benefit of this court's recent en banc decision in Wade v. McDade, and consequently applied the wrong legal standard when evaluating Mr. Chapman's claim for deliberate indifference as to defendant Waugh.
Could you explain the policy issue for me? I'm just having a hard time seeing evidence in the record that there is a policy that affected the eye surgery issue.
So that's in defendant in the defendant's record in the declaration of Dr. Hood. The policy, according to Dr. Hood, according to the evidence that the defendant submitted, is that Mr. Chapman cannot receive the surgery because he lacks one of two conditions. And so it's just a blanket policy. Based on my understanding, it's a blanket policy.
And how is that policy deliberately indifferent to his condition?
Well, the deliberate indifference here is a question of fact for a jury to conclude. I mean, the reason the policy matters is that Mr. Chapman sued defendant Ham in his official capacity.
Right.
Defendant Ham is the proper defendant for suing based on a constitutional violation due to some blanket.
Yeah, but you have it. Maybe I'm wrong about this. I thought there was evidence in the record from a doctor that said that the surgery isn't medically necessary for him.
The evidence in the record is that it's because he doesn't have one of two conditions.
Right.
The prison doesn't consider it an emergency. That's not the deliberate indifference standard. I mean, as this court's clarified, the deliberate indifference standard is whether a defendant is acting with subjective awareness of a serious risk of harm to an inmate's health or safety. Mr. Chapman has alleged and states that he is functionally blind in this right eye. Doctors have been recommending that he have surgery. Based on this evidence, a reasonable fact finder could conclude that this constitutes deliberate indifference to Mr. Chapman's serious medical needs. The Ninth Circuit in Caldwell v. Bannister concluded that a prison's blanket one-eye policy based on the facts of a record where the prison is only giving surgery to one eye, has a one-eye policy for cataract surgery, a reasonable jury could conclude that that violates the Eighth Amendment.
Let me ask you this, just so I understand. Is your principal contention, though, that the district court just like never got into any of this because it sort of knocked it out on sovereign immunity and you just say sort of that was an error and you're content for that issue to be sent back to the district court for a determination in the first instance?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so can I ask you a statute of limitations question? One thing that sort of puzzles me about the statute of limitations issue in this case is it, somehow it's tied. I think everybody recognizes, although the district court might have not have recognized, but I think we in this courtroom recognize that it's tied to when he had reasonable notice of his injury. He's presumably had notice of some injury, that he had an ear infection earlier on, but he didn't have notice maybe of the full extent of his injury. What's the trigger?
Right. The trigger is the date upon which he reasonably became aware of the injury that's causing damage that forms the basis of his claim. That was January 1st, 2018. This is not a statute of repose. It's a statute of limitations. The relevant date is not the last time Nurse Wall saw him. The relevant date is when he had these catastrophic injuries, a brain injury.
Yeah, and so just to follow up on Judge Newsom's question, because in this case, it seems more like a situation where, you know, let's say you're a, let me just give you a hypothetical. You're in a prison and you're a prisoner and you break your leg and you go to the doctor and the doctor doesn't treat your leg, doesn't set your leg, is deliberately indifferent to your condition. And then that condition gets worse and worse and worse and worse. And then eventually, you know, your leg has to be amputated or something because it's just never treated. When would the statute of limitations start running for that?
I believe the statute of limitations would start running when the prisoner understands what is the injury upon which I'm suing and seeking damages for. And I actually apologize, I didn't cite this in my brief, but I didn't become aware of it until recently, but there's actually a case out of the Seventh Circuit with a similar set of facts that I think this court would find helpful in understanding this issue, because I understand that the issue you're getting at is, you know, in August 2017, he had this appointment with Nurse Waugh. He understood that, you know, she didn't treat him, she didn't help him, he had this ear infection, and then after that, it's getting worse and worse. But it wasn't until January when he really understood the true extent of his injuries.
Yeah, and I guess that's the thing. I mean, does he have to understand the extent of his injury or just that he's been injured? And I guess that's the point. Like, this is not, for example, in Wade, the situation is the he's not given the prescription medication, and then eventually he has a seizure where he's injured. And there I can understand where the seizure is where you would start the statute of limitations. But here, you know, to go Judge Newsom's point, it's more of a continuum, right? I mean, he has the ear infection, it's not treated, it sort of gets worse and worse and worse and worse, and this whole time he's experiencing an ear infection. Why doesn't the statute of limitations start when the nurse is deliberately indifferent to him and he has the ear infection and then his just injury gets worse?
Right, because he didn't understand the substance of his claim until January 1st, 2018. And again, apologies, I can submit supplemental briefing, but this case is 705F3rd765.
Well, I'm sorry, would you just repeat it so I can write it down?
Yeah, 705F3rd765, Devbrow v. Kalu. It's out of the Seventh Circuit. There, an inmate went into prison. He understood that when he went into prison, he had a serious risk of developing prostate cancer. And when he was in prison, he told prison officials of this risk.
Yeah. You know, just for the future, you're supposed to file a 28J letter when you have new supplemental authorities and not just raise them in oral argument. Did you file a 28J letter?
No, this is not.
Did you show this supplemental authority to the other side?
No, I just recently discovered this and I'm
okay.
Gonna.
Yeah, so you really are supposed to do that because it's just you're sort of ambushing the other side with a case that they've never read or they don't know it exists and we don't know it exists either. So I'm sure we can look up and find it, but I think you should probably talk about the arguments that you actually made and not make a new argument.
Well, let me go to the argument that you did make. There's a Supreme Court case called Wallace versus Cato. Justice Scalia writes that under general accrual principles for 1983 actions, the standard rule is that accrual occurs when the plaintiff has a complete and present cause of action. So how do you apply that standard to what happened here?
Right, the complete and present cause of action, because Mr. Chapman is not suing for didn't sue, you know, immediately after that appointment for theoretical damage he might have suffered after he had that appointment. Mr. Chapman is suing because in January of 2018, his claim was complete. He understood that what the damage was that forms the basis of his complaint, and that is the damage he is seeking relief for. That was.
I'm speaking only for myself, but I think also relevant, although not dispositive, in the accrual calculation is the fact that when he went to see the nurse, he was told, you have no problem. And he's not a medical professional, so he's told, you're perfectly okay. And then nothing else happens. So there's an argument that the accrual should be at a later point in time when something goes wrong for him. It's not like the nurse said, yes, there's something wrong with you, but I'm going to prescribe X treatment as opposed to Y treatment. That would be a different scenario, but he's told, you're okay. There's nothing wrong with your ears. And it seems to me that that's somewhat relevant to the accrual question. But is, I have a question for, procedural question for you. Is this special report procedure codified in the district court's local rules?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. My understanding is what the district court was trying to do here, given that Mr. Chapman is incarcerated, was manage a quasi-discovery process.
I know. That special report thing has been lingering in this circuit since the 80s, and it's now, in my opinion, mushroomed into a quasi-mini Rule 56 procedure without adequate procedural safeguards. I mean, here, the district court never expressed, the magistrate judge never expressly tells the parties, okay, I was thinking of converting all of this to summary judgment. Now I've decided I'm going to. So there's no Rule 56 notice to either side that, yes, I'm going to go ahead and do this. That's just one of many issues that I see with that special report process here. But you don't think it's codified in the district court's local rules?
As far as I'm aware, I'm not intimately familiar with the district court's rules. I wasn't representing Mr. Chapman in the district court, so as far as I'm aware, I'm not sure the answer to that question. I see I'm running out of time. If I could just, I reserve 5 minutes of my time.
It's okay. You can wrap up.
Okay. Just with respect to going to the summary judgment standard, I just want to point the court's attention to one particular issue. It's not accurate, as Nurse Waugh states in her brief, that Mr. Chapman failed to submit affidavits and evidence disputing the defendant's facts here. Mr. Chapman actually did. He filed multiple responses to these special reports. And those responses, importantly, Mr. Chapman included his own affidavit that substantially complied with 28 U.S.C. Section 1746 for unsworn affidavit. He stated that he was submitting these filings under the penalty of perjury. He obviously doesn't have access to a notary while he's in prison. But the court can see this for itself. That's at dockets 43, page 37, and dockets 47, page 24.
Those weren't docketed until after the case had been closed, right?
No, those were docketed before the case had been closed. There's an additional filing, you're correct. Docket 63, for whatever reason, Mr. Chapman swears he mailed that in timely in November, but I don't understand why. It was not entered onto the docket until March after final judgment had entered, so the district court didn't consider that. But there, too, Mr. Chapman again contested the facts as the defendants had raised in their special reports, and he included an affidavit at that, citing to 28 U.S.C. Section 1746 for an unsworn affidavit.
All right. Thank you very much. You've saved your 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Pigott.
Good morning, may it please the court. I am Phil Pigott, and I represent Commissioner John Hamm and Charlie Waugh, who is a CRNP, Certified Registered Nurse Practitioner. There are two appellees remaining in this case, Commissioner Hamm and Ms. Waugh, or Nurse Waugh. Commissioner Hamm was not the commissioner of the ADOC back in 2018 or 19. In fact, he did not become the commissioner in 2022. But if we're taking it that he is sued just as the commissioner, even though he wasn't the commissioner back there.
Yeah, he's sued as an official capacity, right?
He's sued in his official capacity. Right. It is conceded that the court was correct in dismissing the monetary claims against Commissioner Hamm in his official capacity, and then the issue is raised as to whether the court considered the equitable claims. Even though they're not in the magistrate's report, throughout the special report process, the court did seek additional information from the medical providers not from Ms. Waugh, but from Corizon, who had the contract with the ADOC at that time. And the court said, you know, please provide supplemental declarations or please supply additional information with regards to Mr. Chapman's medical condition and medical treatment. And declarations were provided by Hugh Hood, who was the medical director of Corizon at that time. And Dr. Hood's declaration, supplemental declaration, was contained in document 53-1 and said that and the equitable relief was only for the eyes and not the ears. It was only for the right eye. He had already received surgery for the left eye.
Just so I'm clear, I'm just trying to figure out sort of where we're headed. So are you now talking about the legal issue that's been presented about the sovereign immunity issue? Do you dispute that if there is a request for prospective injunctive relief with respect to the cataract surgery on the eye, that there is no sovereign immunity that attaches to that?
Yes.
You agree with that?
I would agree with that.
And you agree that the district court was wrong in concluding otherwise?
No, I think that the ADOC contracted with Corizon back there, and it was Corizon who provided medical treatment to the inmates, not the ADOC. And the ADOC deferred to the medical providers to provide medical care to Alabama State inmates. And Dr. Hood found in his declaration that that the surgery to the right eye was not medically necessary, that he did not have glaucoma and he did not have diabetic retinopathy, and therefore there was no need at that juncture for surgery in the right eye.
So that's fine. I might be misunderstanding, but that all seems to me to run to the merits of a deliberate indifference claim, right? But you've argued in your brief, never mind the merits. In fact, I don't really even think you'd argue the merits. You say the commissioner is entitled to sovereign immunity with respect to that claim.
Well, we're going to switch over to the deliberate indifference because there's no claim of deliberate indifference against Commissioner Hamm. I think
sure
I think
there is.
There is?
Yes.
Well that's the official, let me switch over to the deliberate indifference. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
There's an official capacity claim now against Commissioner Hamm because he holds the position, right?
Correct.
You agree with that?
Yes.
And he's just substituted in place because they're suing the entity, not the person, right?
Correct.
Okay. It's pretty well established 1983 law, I think, that sovereign or 11th Amendment immunity does not bar a properly stated claim for prospective injunctive relief. You agree with that or disagree with that?
I agree with that.
Okay. So one of the claims, the eye surgery claim, pled against the commissioner was that the Department of Corrections was acting in a deliberately indifferent way by not providing him surgery for the other eye. Whatever happens to that claim on the merits, right, that claim is not barred by sovereign immunity, is it?
No, but I think that the issue is that the court, the magistrate judge, or the district court judge did not even address the claim for equitable relief.
That's a problem. That's a problem.
Didn't address it because it thought that sovereign immunity barred it.
I don't think that's what the court thought. I think the court did not address it because the court asked for information from Corizon, who's not an appellee to this case, as to the condition of Mr. Chapman and the need for the surgery, and we filed a supplemental declaration of Dr. Hood from Corizon, who neither are appellees in this case, who said at that juncture the eye surgery was not medically necessary.
And so
the court, I can presume, the magistrate judge and the district court judge, thought that they were not going to grant equitable relief due to the fact that it was not medically necessary.
But there's no indication, and as I read the magistrate judge's report, there's no indication that it was considered as a prospective injunctive relief claim. The magistrate judge, to the extent the magistrate judge analyzed the merits of the claim, he thought it was a supervisory liability claim under 1983, like a respondeat superior claim. That's on pages 18 through 20 of the report. There is no discussion of whether or not a proper claim for prospective injunctive relief has been pled. As a matter of fact, there's no discussion in the section dealing with then Commissioner Dunn about the eye. There's nothing. So you may be right about the ultimate merits, but it's not a supervisory liability claim. It's not a claim that, hey, because your employee was deliberately indifferent, you were deliberately indifferent. It's an official capacity claim.
I can't answer for what the magistrate.
I get it. No, nobody is trying to press any omissions by the magistrate judge on you, but you're here defending a ruling, and so you're stuck with having to talk about what the magistrate judge and the district court did or did not do, for better or for worse.
And at least, as I've read your brief, you don't engage the merits of the deliberate indifference issue with respect to the cataract claim. You just say we're entitled to sovereign immunity.
The only thing, well, because it really wasn't addressed, but the only thing that I can think of is that throughout doing the special report, the judge did ask for additional information, for supplemental declarations, for us to file information with regards to the status of his eye.
I guess what I mean is that insofar as the arguments have been joined before us, isn't your defense of this issue in your brief, we're entitled to sovereign immunity? That's the way I read pages 52 to 55 of your brief. And I frankly just don't think that's right.
And I think I would probably concede with Your Honor with that we were entitled to it on the monetary relief. We were not entitled to it on the equitable relief. The court, both the magistrate judge and the district court judge, or the magistrate judge at the special report level, asked for separate information. And I can't presume, but I would presume that looking at that information, because he did not ask for further supplemental information, that he took that as sufficient information with regards to the status of his eye, whether it was a medical emergency at that time, and therefore, you know, decided to not proceed with granting equitable relief. Yeah. I mean, that's me thinking.
Well, just to give the magistrate judge the benefit here, I mean, this was a pro se complaint that really wasn't even much of a complaint. It was a form that was filled out, right? So they're trying to figure out what he's really asking for when they're trying to figure these out. Let me ask you a statute of limitations question. I do have some concerns with the district court statute of limitations reasoning here, because it seems like what the district court was saying is just the statute is going to run from the last act of the defendant, our last, you know, inaction of the defendant, and not from the injury, which is not what the law is.
Charlie Waugh, the nurse practitioner, saw Mr. Chapman on one occasion. That occasion was on August the 10th, 2017. And the allegations are that she refused to treat Mr. Chapman. But the fact is that Ms. Waugh saw Mr. Chapman at the chronic care clinic. It was a regularly scheduled clinic where Mr. Chapman came to be seen on a regular basis. Chronic care is usually seen 3 months or 6 months. And he was seen for high blood pressure, asthma, and his lipid condition. And at that time, Ms. Waugh took his vital signs, reviewed the labs with him, and during that chronic care clinic, Mr. Chapman raised to Ms. Waugh that he also had an ear infection. Ms. Waugh did not refuse to see him, did not treat him, and say what she could have done, or sometimes they do, is they say, well, if you got something outside of the chronic care clinic.
Well, that's not what he says, though, right? I mean, that's what she says.
Is
it Mr. Waugh or Ms. Waugh? I'm sorry. The nurse is a man or woman.
It's a woman.
A woman, yeah, okay. So, I mean, that's not what he says about her treatment of him, right?
He says, he says he made she was rude, right, and she was performed just a cursory examination of her. Yeah.
But so why does any of that matter for the statute of limitations? I mean, I could understand if you were arguing about the merits of deliberate indifference, but I mean, why does the statute of limitations start to run from that appointment and not from when his ear infection progresses to the point where it's an abscess in his brain and he's, you know, unconscious?
Because she performed, when she performed the examination of him, which she did not say, no, you need to fill out a sick call and go see somebody else, you know, you're only here for chronic care. She at that time performed tympanic membrane bilateral vision of him, and she noted on this chart that both the tympanic membranes were pearly white and there was no drainage. She saw no signs
right,
of infection.
That's exactly the point. That may help you on the merits, but I don't think it helps you on the statute of limitations. How is this situation any different than somebody in the outside world going to a doctor and saying, you know, I think I have some intestinal issues. I think I've got some blockage. The doctor examines the person, whether it's a good or bad examination, but does an examination and says, you're perfectly okay. You got nothing. Here's some suppositories for you. You should be okay in a couple of days. A week later, an organ burst open because of some blockage issue. When does the statute of limitations begin to run? When the doctor examined the patient or when the organ ruptured a week or two later?
Well, it depends on if there's a linkage, I think. Between...
There is a linkage because the claim is a malpractice claim. And I know it's not a 1983 claim, but the claim is you committed malpractice. Translated over to the 1983 world, you committed deliberate indifference by not correctly diagnosing a claim. I know the standards for liability are very different, but for statute of limitations purposes, isn't the accrual question the very same thing?
I don't think that there has been a linkage, Your Honor, between his surgery 4 months later and him having perhaps a...
He claims that there is.
But there's no medical evidence that there is.
But that you don't need the medical evidence for the statute of limitations accrual question. That's a merits question.
Are you giving up on the statute of limitations accrual issue? Is that what you're doing?
No.
Okay, well then make your argument on the statute of limitations. Why does the statute of limitations start running from the doctors, the nurses?
From the statute of limitations, when she sees him there, that he had complained of having an infection. She saw no infection.
Right.
And the infection that came that caused the surgery 4 months later could have begun 2 months later. There's no, that's what the magistrate judge
could have been. Could have been a week later.
So all your, I think what you're doing now is you're saying like she shouldn't be found liable. You're saying she shouldn't be found liable, but I don't think you've demonstrated that the lawsuit is time barred.
I think let me switch on to the deliberate indifference if I can.
Isn't that what you're talking about? So, all right, I'm really confused because I thought I understood the statute of limitations argument. Now I don't understand it anymore. So I thought the argument was something along the lines of this, that if the ear infection had anything to do with the brain abscess, head abscess, maybe brain is not right, but it started at that appointment and the injury was present already at that appointment. I thought that was the argument.
Can you say that again, Your Honor?
Well, I thought the point that the district court made in the statute of limitations analysis is that the injury that he is complaining about, which is the abscess and the unconsciousness and all the things that have happened to him, that all of that injury goes back to, if it has anything to do with that appointment at all, it goes back to the infection. And so that injury pre-existed. It existed at the time of that appointment. So he could already file his lawsuit at the time of the appointment.
I think that the way that I read the magistrate's recommendation was that there was no, I think it said there was no linkage between the surgery that happened 4 months after he saw Ms. Waugh.
I mean, candidly, I don't think you want to rely on the magistrate judge's reasoning, because as I read the magistrate judge's reasoning, you know, he says, look, December 11 is the last time they had any contact, and that's the last time, therefore, that she could have, quote, engaged in any of the challenged conduct about which the plaintiff complains. That's not a statute of limitations.
Well, the magistrate judge brings that up because that was Ms. Waugh's last date of employment. Yeah.
Right, but he's focusing on the conduct, and that's just like not the focus.
Right, that's not the law. Right?
That's not the law. That might be statute of repose, but that's not statute of limitations.
The magistrate does not go back to the date when Ms. Waugh saw Mr. Chapman, which was August 10th, 2017.
No, I know. He says, look, December 11. He's like, you know, he's being generous. December 11, I'll give you December 11. That's the last date they could have interacted, and that's the last date, therefore, that she could have engaged in conduct. That is not the law of statute of limitations, right?
I would agree with you.
Okay.
I would agree with you.
So I guess what I'm saying is I don't think you want to, like, try to, like, ground yourself in the magistrate's report. You might have a different argument for why you think the statute of limitations.
It would have been better if the magistrate judge had gone back to August 10th, 2017, as opposed to Ms. Waugh's.
Why would that make it any better for you on statute of limitations? Because causation, linkage, that's a merits issue. That's not a statute of limitations issue. And he's claiming that the improper diagnosis, again, I know it's just a claim. He's claiming that the improper treatment, diagnosis, et cetera, by Nurse Waugh is what led to his issues months down the line.
That is his claim.
Don't you have to accept that for statute of limitations purposes?
I would say no, that it's triggered at the date of the wrongful treatment or the alleged wrongful treatment.
Okay, why is that? So let me ask you this. Could he have filed this lawsuit the day after that doctor's appointment?
With the nurse practitioner?
Right.
Yes.
Okay, why is that?
Because that would have been within the statute of limitations.
No, I'm saying... No, I'm saying, would he have this claim? Would the claim exist? Could he have filed the lawsuit?
I would have thought, if he had filed it within the statute of limitations, it still should have been dismissed.
No.
Because there is
okay,
no deliberate indifference.
Never
okay,
mind.
Okay, you're not engaging with us.
He's over his time.
If I know, but I want to try to make you understand where we're coming from, because I think we all have a very different vision of accrual than you might. If you're right that the statute of limitations began to run when Nurse Waugh saw him, Judge Brasher's point to you is essentially, he would have been able to file a ripe lawsuit the very next day.
Correct.
So the answer is yes, he could have filed a lawsuit the very next day.
Could have filed a lawsuit the very next day.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. I just want to start quickly with the immunity claim. I just want to make clear that Mr. Chapman and his filings did make very clear he was seeking prospective injunctive relief. His amended complaint, I understand they're handwritten filings and it's a lot of filings, but he did say he wants cataract surgery in his right eye. That's docket 10, page 4. He also made this again numerous times in dockets 43, docket 47. So it was very clear from the record what Mr. Chapman was seeking. Just with respect to my friend on the other side's assertion that Mr. Chapman could have filed a lawsuit the next day, his claim was not ripe until January 1st, 2018. The reason he is suing is because he is seeking damages for the injury caused because he had a ruptured eardrum, a brain abscess, and mastoiditis. He had no idea he had that damage until January.
So is the idea that like maybe the next day he could have filed some lawsuit, but it would have been a lawsuit for, I don't know, like minor inconvenience as a result of some ear infection. But it wouldn't have been this lawsuit. It wouldn't have been remotely this lawsuit because this lawsuit is focused on some much worse thing.
Right. The substance of his claim would be materially completely different. I mean, one, he probably would have been suing for injunctive relief at that point because he would have been saying, my prison's not treating me for an ear infection. Get me antibiotics.
He wouldn't have really had any damages, is your point.
He wouldn't have had any. He would have had damages for, I don't know, some inconvenience from an ear infection. But that's not what happened here. He had these catastrophic injuries in January 2018. That is what he's seeking relief for.
Is there the weirdness of the, like, as Judge Brasher points out, the continuation, the continuing nature of the harm is that like, is there any obligation of a plaintiff in this circumstance to go ahead and file and then, like, amend as things get worse?
I mean, not as far as I'm aware. I mean, again, the issue here is that he had this damage from Nurse Waugh's deliberate indifference. He did not understand what that injury was. What is that injury that forms the basis of my complaint and which forms, which I'm seeking relief for, what I'm seeking damages for? That's January 1st of 2018. It's not a statute of repose. This is a statute of limitations. In the remaining time, I just want to talk about there is evidence in the record raising a dispute of fact at summary judgment about what happened at that August 2017 appointment. I would just like to draw the court's attention to Mr. Chapman's evidence, which, again, because he submitted affidavits signed under the penalty of perjury, this is competent admissible evidence raising a dispute of fact at summary judgment about that appointment. According to Mr. Chapman, he showed Nurse Waugh evidence that he had had blood and pus coming out of his ears and that he had this longstanding untreated ear infection. Mr. Chapman is 60 years old. He's incarcerated. It would have been, you know, a reasonable medical professional would have understood that, you know, if you just dismiss an inmate's complaints and refuse to even treat him, an infection could get worse.
Can I ask you to address this? See if this is a good rule for you. That we say that a deliberate indifference claim accrues when the serious harm develops. So the deliberate indifference claim is that someone was deliberately indifferent to a substantial risk of serious harm. Therefore, the deliberate indifference claim accrues once the serious harm presents itself. What do you think about that rule?
That rule would be applicable here. I mean, it would help me here, I think. I mean, the serious harm is
I think it would, too. So what do you think about it just as a general matter? I mean, does that make sense for a rule that we could adopt?
Sorry, I didn't hear you.
Does that make sense for a rule that we could adopt? I mean, in the sense that it comports the accrual time with the nature of the underlying claim?
I think so, but I mean, the deliberate indifference standard, I mean, the standard for when a deliberate indifference claim accrues is pretty well baked in. It's when an inmate reasonably could have become aware of his injuries due to an act of a defendant. I mean, the focus really is on the injury, the harm, the damage. What damage am I suing over? What's my injury? When did that happen? When did I reasonably become aware of it? Mm-hmm. That was January 1st, 2018. Before that, Mr. Chapman had an ongoing run-of-the-mill, what he thought was not run-of-the-mill ear infection. His prison was not treating it. He had no idea what the extent of his injury was.
But he knew that he had some injury, though. I guess that's the problem that I keep going back to, is that there's some injury, and it's related to the ultimate thing that you're suing over. And so why doesn't this claim accrue then?
Because the focus is on the injury upon which he is the basis of his complaint is formed. That's January 1st, 2018. He's not suing because he had an annoying ear infection for about 8 months. He's suing because he had catastrophic medical consequences that he didn't discover until he was passed out on the floor of his prison, having a seizure and then having to undergo major emergency medical treatment for a huge infection in his head. In my remaining time, back to some of the record evidence, there is a linkage here that I think a reasonable jury, looking at the evidence in the light most favorable to Mr. Chapman, which again the district court was required to do, and it's clear here the district court really only credited the defendant's account of that August 2017 appointment. But in the medical records, when he was being treated at the University of Alabama Hospital, the medical records there do note that the consequences he suffered were likely caused because of a sinus infection that had gone untreated. That's dockets 53-1, page 61, dockets 53-1, page 78. There's plenty of evidence in the record that a reasonable trier of fact, again, looking at the evidence in the light most favorable, Mr. Chapman, could have concluded that Nurse Waugh's deliberate indifference caused his injuries later, which again, as this court correctly pointed out, I mean, the causation here is a question on the merits, and it's a question for a trier of fact.
The weird thing about this,
to me is that the tighter you try to draw the linkage for merits purposes, the more trouble I think you have on the statute side, and the more sort of space you try to create for statute purposes, the tougher it becomes for you on the merits. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. And it's true for you and for your adversary, right? The sort of the weaker the connection they want for merits purposes, as Judge Jordan was pointing out, worse for them on statute. The tighter the connection, better for them on statute, worse for them on the merits. It's just that everything is sort of at cross purposes.
Right. But I mean, the deliberate indifference standard, I mean, and this isn't a novel standard. I mean, it's the standard in a lot of medical malpractice cases. I mean, your claim in this kind of case, it does not accrue until you are reasonably aware of your injuries that form the basis of your complaint. Those injuries here, a brain abscess, a ruptured eardrum, and a bone infection, having to undergo incredibly invasive and emergency surgery, it's not, Mr. Chapman is not suing just because he had an ear infection.
All right, we've taken you way beyond your time, but thank you both very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.